Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Host Tucker Perkins recorded this special episode from Reuters Energy Transition North America in Houston, where he talked to business leaders and other experts at the forefront of driving climate innovation. Now, here's Tucker.
One of the perks of hosting this podcast is getting to meet academic experts on a range of environmental and energy topics. My guest for this episode, Dr. Rachel Meidel from Rice University here in Houston, is one of the leading experts on hazardous waste and energy resiliency. A fellow at Rice's Baker Institute for Public Policy, Dr. Meidel has more than 20 years of experience in industry, academia, government, politics, and international relations. Dr. Meidel, what an honor to have you in Houston at Path to Zero. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We got lots to talk about, but let's start off by talking about Rice and the Baker Institute. What's the purpose?
Well, we are a public policy think tank. We are nonpartisan. We are ranked number one in the world, Center for Energy Studies, when it comes to university-affiliated think tanks that focus on energy and natural resources. And our mission is to bring actionable policy changes, so to bridge the gap between policy and practice. And we do that in a number of ways. We do that through nonpartisan, data-driven research. We do that through our convening power, and we do that through a lot of collaboration. So whether that's working with industries, working with NGOs, working with different levels of government to help guide different types of policy pathways. And so we just had our 30th anniversary at the Baker Institute that was founded by former Secretary of State James A. Baker III. Like I said, we focus on a lot of different issues. Energy is just one of them. We have Center for Health and Biosciences, Center for U.S. and Mexico. We have programs on drug policy, on space policy, and elections. And so we cover a whole host of domestic and foreign policy issues.
So exciting. What drew you there?
Well, I had worked in a lot of different areas throughout my 27-year career, starting off as a hazardous materials chemist. And I worked for a lot of different industries for the company that I was working for. I worked as a government contractor. I worked for, you know, a company managing hazardous waste, managing environmental regulations. I did that for a lot of my earlier part of my career, and I moved into more of the operational roles of different facilities where we manage radiological, biohazardous waste, chemical, range of chemical waste, and I was always very drawn to policy. I saw the influencing power policy could have both at the local, state, national, and international levels. And the work that I was doing, I was steeped in a lot of different types of policies, whether it was transportation law, hazardous waste law, treatment storage, environmental, you know, regulations, and so it got me interested into policy. You know, that's when I really was interested in moving over to D.C. And so I spent some years there working for a trade association, American Chemistry Council, and I later moved over into the government space and was a senior executive for the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. And so after I kind of covered all those bases and got different perspectives and different experiences in those roles, I was very much interested in how can I amalgamate all of those different things and help elevate discussions on environmental, economic, and social issues. And I thought, you know, working at a think tank, especially one that's nonpartisan, will allow me to tap into that intellectual yearning that I wanted.
What a great career. You know, we've had a lot of guests talking about a lot of things. I don't think we've ever had a guest to focus exclusively on hazardous waste and maybe the environment. So let's burrow into that. That's really been your thing, right? That's what you do.
It has.
Why is that such a critical topic?
Well, the issue of waste is something, I mean, it's something that's been at the forefront for me because, you know, I've seen not just how waste is generated in different industries and different sectors in the United States, but from early on in my career and through the different travels I had in various roles, I saw how much perspective matters and you know, waste is created throughout the entire life cycle, throughout the entire supply chain, and a lot of our waste ended up being it is exported and managed, treated, disposed outside of our borders, and that's something that I experienced and witnessed in my years working in overseas contracts, and I saw the types of waste increasing, becoming more complex, the volumes just exponentially growing, and you know, the systems that are in place, the laws and the regulations, we're not keeping pace with that, or not even really focusing on, you know, things at the end of life. And
very
so,
much out of sight, out of mind. Let's forget about it.
Very much so. And so I've always taken the systems perspective. And so those experiences really galvanized my interest in waste in looking at it at the global level, because we can't, you know, in these days talking about sustainability, we can't achieve sustainability if we're just looking within our borders. We have to really look at the full life cycle, and waste management is a part of the life cycle, and it's oftentimes overlooked in these conversations, especially in conversations in energy transitions and sustainability.
And as you think about waste and the energy transition and maybe even the full economic cycle, which is interesting, I'm thinking about it, other than wind turbines and maybe vehicle batteries, it's not a conversation we have. So is there a particular area of concern or anxiety as we think about this, and you're like, that's not being talked about?
Well, every source of energy and every type of technology, it all generates waste. And everything, in fact, everything we use is either grown or mined and can be ultimately traced back to the physical sources of raw materials, whether it's food, fiber, timber, fossil resources that provide plastics and chemicals for everyday living, and everything has an end of life. And so when we talk about transitioning from energy, perspective matters in that, because depending on what region of the world you sit in, you have a very different experience with that. And, you know, you also have to deal with the brunt of the end of life issues that we're not addressing in our policies and in what we're putting out into the market. And so it's a very relevant topic, but it's something that I see is not discussed in holistically in policy making. And so, you know, electric vehicles and the lithium-ion batteries, and you mentioned solar panels and wind turbine blades and electrolyzers that that create the electricity for green hydrogen, and a host of other different types of electronics that we need in a diversified energy future. I mean, all of those create waste, but our policies don't reflect the full life cycle, and that's an area that I focus on, because I see a dearth of dearth of research in that, a dearth of funding available for full life cycle thinking, and it's a real miss, because essentially we're shifting the waste management burden to sensitive populations and populations in developing economies.
Do you think that omission is purposeful, or is it just that sometimes I think the scale of this transition is so behemoth, no one can think about it credibly from beginning to end? And sometimes I think it's purposeful in that people just don't want to acknowledge the dirty parts of their particular technology. Which do you think that is?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I don't think people deliberately want to generate waste and not take responsibility for it, but I do see that there is a recognition that, you know, that it is an issue, but like I said, I mean, our policies and our actions don't reflect that. You know, if we're not including metrics that help us understand the waste that's generated, say from from the mining and processing of the metals and materials that we need for electric vehicles and for solar, and the social impacts and the environmental and health impacts from populations that are, you know, in corrupt regimes that lack those type of, then we are essentially turning a blind eye to that. And so I think it's, you know, I think it's a little bit of both, but, you know, in this rush to transition away fossil fuels, I think there, a lot of investments are going into product-based solutions instead of thinking about life cycles. And so I always say, think in systems, design in life cycles. And it's really about bridging the R&D, bridging the upstream with the downstream players. And so you can't just keep pushing things into the market without understanding how it's going to, have impact and reverberations, or if it can even be recycled or reused or repurposed. And that's where we need greater focus and greater collaborations and more partnerships.
All right, let's play a little fast game here and think about some energy technologies and then the waste, and to see what you think about it. Nuclear and uranium. Solution? You have solutions for that?
Well, I mean, as far as waste solutions,
what to do with the uranium?
Well, I mean, I think there's different nuclear technologies that we can tap into, that more modular forms that don't generate as much waste. But I think the public perception of that and the palatability, we're not there yet. And so so part of sustainability is really the consumer receiving end of it and getting the public buy-in. And I think with that, we're kind of a ways, even though that could be a viable solution and a zero emission solution from, one perspective, it's bringing the public and the policymakers along with that.
But as you say, probably technology is going to improve that problem. And it's a little bit of a perception. Maybe the problem's not as quite as big as people think.
Right.
Okay, let's keep going. Solar panel. Is it mainly around the glass, or is it bigger than the glass?
For the waste part of it? Oh, it's all of it. It is a very complex multi-material technology, and there's different generations and varieties of solar panels. And
full of some sensitive chemicals around the electronics?
Oh, right? Absolutely. Different types of metals. Some metals are classified as hazardous waste by EPA through the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. So that one is an interesting one. I mean, how sustainable can we call something, or how green or renewable is something if the only way to manage it right now is to landfill it or to incinerate it or to kind of donating it to secondary markets?
Or worse, have to landfill it in a hazardous waste landfill, right?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of valuable resources in these things that are ending up in landfills and that we're incinerating. But we don't have scale technologies to recycle at the moment. But one good thing about solar panels right now is, although there's no national policy on how to classify it, the EPA is looking at reclassifying solar panels as a type of universal waste. So it's like a lower categorization of hazardous waste that will help with the collection and recycling of that. And so the regulatory burdens associated with that classification are not as great as if it were classified as hazardous waste. But right now, many of the solar panels that are out there could be classified as hazardous waste. And we don't know where some of them are coming, because a lot of these components and materials come from China, and that's creating more waste. So the panels are not reaching their true manufacturer lifetime. We have tax incentives that that are creating swap out of panels, and then we also have greater efficiency panels coming into the market, which is all generating more solar panels where we don't have an end of life technology to manage those things.
So interesting. No real great solutions that you throw out there yet. Maybe some promises, but no
right.
great solution.
Not yet. And that's and that's something that I try to bring awareness to, is that you can't just focus on the use phase. You can't just focus on the product. If you look at the whole thing in its entirety, from all of the material sourcing of the material, which many are not even mined here, and if they are mined here, the materials and minerals, they're all processed in China. And how they do that in China, a lot of that is fueled using coal. And then, if you look at all the way beyond the use phase to the end of life, there's no scale technology to manage that. And so then you have to ask yourself, how renewable is this if we can't manage the waste? How renewable and sustainable is something if the only option for management is landfilling or incineration.
Wind turbine blades.
Yes, that's another.
Are they a real problem?
They're a huge problem, massive problem. And so I think, let me see, as far as wind turbine blades, I think in 2021, over 8,000 blades were decommissioned. And then between 2030 to 2040, between 10 to 20,000 blades will be decommissioned annually. And right now they're all going to a landfill. And you know, although they're not considered hazardous waste, they are considered a waste material that has to be managed in a landfill, since we don't have a technology right now, scale technology, to recycle them or to reuse them or to repurpose them.
Wow. Vehicle batteries?
Same thing with lithium ion batteries. There are so many different chemistries of batteries that are being pushed onto the market, which makes it very difficult to, at the end of life, to scale a recycling technology around that. There's no scaled operation right now for recycling lithium ion batteries, and that's a big problem. And you know, a lot of the manufacturers that we talk to, I mean, recycling is not something they want to do as an immediate step, because so much so much material and labor and cost went into manufacturing that battery. So the best thing is to perhaps repurpose it, but that's not really happening at the moment. So a lot of the batteries, and so I used to work in the hazardous waste field, and I managed a lot of different materials. Batteries was one of them, lithium ion batteries, and most of those, I mean, they were incinerated because we just didn't have anything at the time, and we still don't have anything at the time to manage them.
Wow. It's just fascinating that these are areas that we rarely hear or read about.
Right. And some of the materials in the batteries can be recycled, but, you know, can you do it economically? And right now we can't. I mean, we have relationships and talk with the battery recyclers, and it's just not economically viable. Now you can recycle maybe fractions of some of the materials in the batteries, but with dematerialization policies where we're reducing some of the materials in the batteries, cobalt is one of them. It's you know, conflict mineral, and there's a lot of human rights issues associated with that. But that's the cobalt is where a lot of the battery recyclers, where they were making their money. And by reducing the amount of cobalt, you know, it also creates another instance where you know, they can't bring, they can't make it economical in their operations.
You wrote a great article about carbon. And you really talk about that we view carbon wrong. Maybe carbon's not the enemy. Talk to our listeners about kind of that writing and maybe where you're going with that.
Sure. I know that when I was thinking about that article, and as I've been working in this industry, my thinking has greatly evolved. And, you know, anytime I can bring quantum mechanics into the conversation, I'd like to do that. But this was really good because I was really inspired by Schrodinger's paradox. Because the more I thought about decarbonization, zero carbon, war on carbon, all of these things, the more I started thinking about the common denominator that kind of runs through all of my research and all of my thinking is systems level thinking, and you know, carbon is such a versatile material. It's so gregarious. It's an extraordinary material. I mean, there's no other element on the periodic table that forms more elements than carbon. And in the right place, carbon can be, you know, a resource. But the way that we, our narrative around carbon is very, very negative. And so I want to change the narrative around that, where we talk in more valuable terms around carbon. I mean, because if you look at carbon as a system, in the carbon cycle, the amount of carbon never changes. It just shifts from reservoir to reservoir, whether it's people or animals or soil, microbes, and different processes change and shift the carbon, you know, respiration, degradation, different processes like fossil fuel production and so forth. But you know, if we want to change the value of carbon and bring value to carbon, then we have to change the narrative and understand that carbon is a valuable resource, and it just depends on where that carbon is stored, how it's used, and creating a circular carbon economy is one way to think about it, where we can extract carbon in various forms, for example, extracting carbon from the atmosphere and recycling that and turning that into valuable carbon resources. If you look at the living carbon, that for example, like biochar or certain types of biomass, where we could use that to increase soil fertility. It provides healthy forests and fresh foods. If we look at the durable working carbon that's stored in plastics, if we were to recycle those and bring that back into the economy. And so my thinking on the carbon is the enemy, carbon is not the enemy, is that, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, it's the carbon cycle, and it's how we manage the carbon at every stage of the life cycle. So instead of demonizing carbon, how can we bring value to it and start talking about it in a way that could help us kind of bridge that gap between where we are, where we have this carbon-centric focus, which I call the carbon tunnel vision, because everything's all about emissions control, right, and climate change. And that brings us into this climate tunnel vision, where we're so hyper-focused on only the carbon emissions, we're forgetting things like water quality, water management, waste management, environmental justice, biodiversity, all of these other things that we say are important, but they're unquantified and not really integrated into these greater discussions around sustainability.
Fascinating point into your original statement. If we really exhibited systems thinking, the whole conversation would be different. Right? It would be a totally different conversation.
That's right. It broadens our view. It broadens that lens. And so we start drawing in other factors. And that's why I ask people, well, I mean, what is it that we want at the end of the day? I mean, is that sustainability? And right now, all of our conversations are around sustainability. It's being driven by the UN Sustainable Development Goals and ESG and the Paris Accord. But if our idea of sustainability is just controlling CO2 emissions, then that's not sustainability. Maybe we should call it something else.
You work for a think tank, nonpartisan, and you think in systems. Do you ever have a thought that all of this work that we're doing, all of this investment that we're making, may actually not be having any impact?
We talk about that a lot at the Baker Institute, between a number of us. But, you know, the way that I look at it, I mean, it's a journey. And it's complicated, and it requires a lot of data. And the only way to access some of this data is through greater partnerships and more transparency. And so, yeah, I mean, there's that fear that we're not doing enough, or maybe we're going in the wrong direction. And but you know, these things take time. It takes a lot of grit. It takes patience. And the only way to get there is to really understand what our desired end state is, and then kind of work backwards and map out a plan for, okay, if we want to get to sustainability, this is how we understand sustainability to be. And this is the data that we have today. This is the data that we need in the future to get to that desired end state. And it's not easy, and it could be very onerous, and for a lot of companies that I talk with, you know, they don't want to go the great distance, or they only want to focus on this right now. But at the end of the day, we have to start looking broader and thinking systems-wide, because if we don't do that, we end up shifting risks. We end up with unintended consequences, and that's what we see happening in the world of waste and other issues in environmental justice and other very important topics.
I'm going to give you one more question, then I'm going to start wrapping up. But as you think about plastics, and maybe first off, from your view, is the issue consumer-based plastics, or is it more industrial-based plastics? What creates the pollution problem?
Well, it's all of it. The greatest focus is on consumer-based plastics and single-use plastics. That's where most of the focus is for the UN Global Plastics Treaty.
Is that where the problem is?
Well, I mean, it's all plastics. It's all plastics, but. And these are the points that I make all the time. I mean, do we really know which plastics are contributing to the issues, and which industries they're coming from, what types of plastics, and then kind of aligning, okay, what type of technologies do we need in order to manage these? Because we can't just focus on consumer plastics and single-use plastics. That's very important for us to do that, since it's a large portion is coming from that. But there's massive amounts of plastics that we don't even know, or that we're not even quantifying, that's going to be entering the waste stream. You know, from solar panels to electric vehicles are made of, our vehicles today are, you know, 50% polymers. And so, you know, how do we manage those plastics? What about the plastics and the batteries and plastics and wind turbines and all of these other things? And so we have to look at it quite holistically to understand how to manage a whole array of different polymer chemistries.
You think we'll use single-use plastics 50 years from now?
Absolutely, I really do. And I mean, it's, if you look at the different uses for it and the necessities for it, and how it helps with you know, reduce food waste, how it's used in the medical field. And
what the alternatives are to single-use plastics, right?
Right, and right now we don't have great alternatives. I mean, we'll continue to develop and innovate. I mean, in the world of hazardous waste, and when I was an emergency responder, I mean, we relied heavily on a lot of different single-use plastics. And so I think we will continue to use a lot of different types of them, only because it's needed at the moment. We don't have alternatives, but like we do in all things, I mean, innovation and technology is a game changer.
Well, okay, let's have some fun. We're going to give you a magic wand, let you use it for one thing in the next year that you think would have the biggest impact on the environmental transition. How would you use your wand?
Well, I would say, if I had that magic wand, it would be to help educate people and policymakers to understand truly what sustainability is, and so it would be to change that thinking, and to gravitate away from sustainability as environment focused or climate focused to sustainability as this. The way that I like to describe this is like a three-legged stool. So sustainability is on one leg, it's the economics. On the other, it's the environment. And on the other is social, and it's really to understand the broad dimensions of sustainability. And that is by far the biggest challenge right now in all of these conversations in energy transitions and sustainability planning, is the lack of understanding of what sustainability truly is. It's hampering our ability to understand from a systems level how we can be more adaptable, how we can be more resilient, how we can be more sustainable.
This conversation is just not occurring in the press. Is it occurring at least in the halls of science and think tanks?
It is to a certain extent, but I think a lot of people, and both policymakers, the general public, I mean, people we interface with, we talk aggressively about accelerating the energy transition, and I don't know if accelerating is the best way to do. I think we need to take a more nuanced approach with that and bridge the upstream with the downstream, bridge more the R&D with the end of life. But yes, these conversations, I mean, I've been in this space for a long time, and I do see a movement towards more adaptive thinking and more kind of circular, broad thinking. And so it's slowly trickling, but it is a challenge, because, you know, everybody wants this net zero and zero emissions decarbonization, and they want to get to what they see as this perceived end state, but sustainability, there's not one pathway to sustainability. There's just like the energy transition, there's going to be multiple pathways, and it's going to look different in sub-Saharan Africa and in the Middle East than it is in Europe or North America. Sustainability is going to look different everywhere too. The pathway is not a singular one, and it's going to change over time.
Fascinating conversation. We could have it for hours and hours yet. One of the things we love to do is to plant a tree in your honor for the time spent, your expertise shared with us. We'd like to go to a national forest. And I always like to predict where you're going to go. You're born and raised in Wisconsin, spent a lot of time around D.C. You live here in Texas now. Where is a national forest you'd love to see a tree planted for you?
Well, being born and raised in Wisconsin, it would be the Shawmigan-Nicolet National Forest.
It's
a beautiful place, rich ecological history with glacial geology that's pretty remarkable.
Where can our listeners learn more about you, maybe follow some of your writings? How do they know more about who you are?
I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, and I have a research library on my page at the Baker Institute.
Good. That's awesome. Dr. Rachel Meidel, Baker Institute. Love having you. Thanks for being with us today on Path to Zero.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.